Hello, I'm Edwin Newman. Speaking freely today is Marshall McLuhan. I'm sure it's not necessary to offer any clues to who Marshall McLuhan is. If there's anybody who does not recognize the name, it should be sufficient to say the medium is the message. However, it might be useful to sketch in a little background. Marshall McLuhan is a Canadian. He's a professor of English at the University of Toronto. He is director at that university of the Center for Culture and Technology. His writings, some of which were done in collaboration with others, include The Gutenberg Galaxy, Understanding Media, The Mechanical Bride, The Medium is the Massage, and most recently, From Cliché to Archetype. Mr. McLuhan, this question is inevitable, I guess. You're probably sick of it. Why is the medium the message? Why is not the message the message?
Where would you look for the message in an electric light?
Is there necessarily a message in an electric light?
There certainly is. Or a candle. The medium and the message are the same. When you think of the medium as a container, you are thinking in visual terms the hidden meaning of a container is the visual habit of man to put something in its place or around something. The visual man has very much an inclination to make things contain things. But visual space has very peculiar properties. Static. Most people think of space as static. As, for example, the space between you and me, as something that is constant. That is, between you and me, there are so many inches or so many measures, and that those are the same no matter who's sitting there. To a preliterate man, space has no static properties at all. They're entirely determined by the people or things that are involved in the spatial relationship. So that a person is thought of as creating his own kind of space and not as being inside space. The preliterate man, the man who lives more by ear than by eye, does not think of himself as being in space at all. There's a delightful little illustration of how preliterate people, children, feel space. A child on his first airplane flight said, as they took off and climbed higher and higher, he said, "Daddy, when do we start to get smaller?" Now, this is true and happening, and it has the immediate feeling of the natural, authentic child observation about space. To an adult, it seems perfectly obvious that the static space in which people are contained would remain the same, and that the people in that space would remain the same. In point of fact, this is an illusion on the part of the adult. The child is much more in tune with the reality than the adult in this matter. The child is replying to or responding to a dynamic space created by changing physical relationships.
If the physical relationship, Professor McLuhan, does not change, as between us, for example, does the space change?
There's an entire study of this sort of thing by Edward Hall. It's called The Silent Language. It's a study of the kinds of spaces that people use between one another in their daily lives. And he points out how in very various parts of the world these spaces vary enormously. And one of the more striking illustrations is the Arab space, preferably 8 inches between people who are friendly, because they like to smell each other.
This is Arab?
Arab.
Arab space.
Now, the visual man prefers the sort of space that there is between you and me. They like to look at each other. They don't think of a friendly relationship as primarily based upon the sense of smell.
As a matter of fact, that's discouraged in our
yes,
society.
Yes, a visual society is very hostile to odors, except as means of disguising physical facts. And this, the more literate the society, the more narrow the sensory area of awareness, the more specialist, the more concentrated on visual factors. A friend of mine was recently on an expedition with some Indians. He has as a job the finding of the proper names, native names, for various places and lakes and rivers in Canada. And on their coming home one evening, they got off trail, and after a while he said to one of the Indians, "We're lost." And the Indian looked quite startled, and he said, "We not lost. Wigwam is lost." The idea, you see, to an Indian, the idea that a human being getting lost is meaningless, because the man makes his own space. Now, the wigwam could get lost because it is not that dynamic factor that the human being is. This Ed Hall's books on the study of spaces between people, personal spaces, are quite startling in their way of revealing our very peculiar assumptions.
Well, to take this one step further, you have written, "It is no longer possible to take a fixed position for more than a single moment." Now, is that meant literally? Do you mean anything literally? Perhaps I should put that question.
Well, you can see that a point of view literally means a static position with a vanishing point. Now, in practice, there is no such position, and perhaps there never was. A person sighting a target with a very high precision instrument, there might be a point of view on a particular object, a target. This idea of a fixed position from which to see things in perspective is of very recent origin in the Western world. And in Shakespeare's time, it was a completely new and exciting experience. It is a kind of outlook that ran into all sorts of difficulties with the scientists in the 17th and 18th centuries, with Newton and others, and Berkeley. The relative position of the visual with regard to the other senses in locating or fixing people's experience in space became a great controversial matter. Newton was Swift was quite amused at Newton's ideas of space, and in effect said Newton did not discover gravity but levity. What Newton discovered was up pull, not down pull. And so Swift turned Newton's world into a joke with the flying island of Laputa. The great scientific utopia of Laputa is airborne, or it's weightless. It's strange that our scientists have given up on weightlessness as a means of solving transportation problems. They've gone for the moon, but they've not thought of anti-gravitation as a way of getting there.
Why do you say they've given up on it, since they do take account of it in space travel?
In what way? Would you say they take account of weightlessness?
Within the capsule. I mean, it does exist within the capsule.
I've often asked myself, when you are weightless, as in a capsule, in a space, would you see things upside down? As you know, the normal human mode of perception is at all times upside down. Why do we turn them right side up? Nobody knows. No psychologist even has a theory about why do we see upside down and turn things right side up. Now, if there's any gravitational cause for this flipping the image, then it would be possible or imaginable that in a weightless state, we would see upside down and keep it upside down. But the Stratton glasses were invented to enable us to, when put on, they turn the world upside down again. It takes a while to, having put them on and seeing the world upside down again, it takes a while before you turn it right side up. It takes several hours. Then if you take the glasses off, the world goes upside down again and stays that way for several hours. Nobody knows why people do this. And it's very strange. And I've often wondered whether weightlessness would in any way affect this. Now, in the Eskimo world, for example, there is no upside down. You know, small children don't see pictures right side up or upside down. It doesn't matter which way you hold it to a small child, say a 2 or 3 year old. It's the same. It's only later that this habit of right side upness begins. Now, why? I don't know, and nobody knows. But in the Eskimo world, there is no attempt made to turn pictures right side up. They stick them on their igloos and so on in any position at all. And they're always amazed when visitors come and start craning their necks around to see these pictures. They think it's very amusing because they don't see any they don't have any upside down. When they're drawing a picture, they're just as happy drawing underneath the table. When they come to the edge of a table, they go under and draw up without seeing as freely as mm-hmm. when they see. They don't need eyes in order to draw. And they don't think of drawing as for the eyes. But this habit of sensory orientation by which we think of space as a fixed container has had an enormous effect upon our ideas of the medium as containing a program.
Before you go ahead on that, may I just ask you, by the way, if the Eskimos do not consider drawings to be, or drawing to be for the eye, what do they consider it?
Oh, tactility has great priority over sight mm-hmm. in their world.
Is it more nearly a form of sculpture then than
yeah.
it is drawing?
And as you know, in contemporary poetry and art, the priority of the sculptural or the tactile has replaced the visual order. The scandal of cubism, or the scandal of much symbolist art, was the scrapping of visual space, the throwing aside of the visual in favor of the audile tactile. Of course, at the same time, quantum mechanics was discovering that the physical or chemical bond was resonance, that there is no connection in matter. That is perhaps another way of coming to this medium and the message thing. In visual space, we think of things as continuous and connected. Eh? There is no connection in auditory space or tactile space. To the sense of touch, there are no connections. There are only resonances, beats, rhythms, closures. And to smell, to all the other senses, kinetic movement and so on, there is no continuity, no connection, only discontinuity. And this idea of the visual man, the Euclidean man, that space is continuous and uniform and connected, does not apply in the electronic age to any of the senses except sight. And under electronic conditions, even the visual has lost that continuous character. Under especially television conditions, it becomes once more a mosaic, a collage of resonant dots, spots.
Are you, Professor McLuhan, seeking to approximate that in any way when in your book or your books you have the chapters readable in any sequence, that they don't have to be read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on?
That, in this particular book, The Cliched Archetype, was the result of having simply created a file of chapters alphabetically and having noticed that they had a kind of dynamic pattern or logic from the absurd to theater. The first chapter was absurd and the last chapter was theater. And it seemed that the intervening order was also a dynamic one. This is the way the book had grown. And so we just hit upon the idea of retaining it as a pattern of growth. This, the idea of pattern recognition, one of the peculiar new awarenesses of our time, is the result of speed up. When things move very quickly, their pattern or form of them appears very plainly. Whereas when things move very slowly, it's not so easy to see a pattern. This has something to do with a lot of the confusions of our world. When people who had previously been quite content in a fixed position in a job or a career are suddenly confronted with very fast-moving situations where they can see overall patterns, they suddenly become very discontented with their place, their fixed position. So the dropout is a normal kind of response to pattern recognition.
This is the global village that you...
No, but I mean, in all aspects of our society, the people who are dropping out right, left, and center are people who suddenly have seen a pattern in their lives. Instead of just a fixed position, visually oriented, everything in its place, a place for everything, a classification, a job, people suddenly want to be involved in more dynamic patterns. For example, a talk show is an example of this new need or demand for involvement in dynamic situations in which two people begin to inquire of each other in such a way that both of them can make discoveries about the other.
Now, is there a need on the part of the viewer for that?
The viewer can participate more fully in such a dialogue than he can in just listening to a packaged delivery. Packaged material, whether it's in the advertising world or in the educational world, is no longer acceptable. The consumer status has been greatly downgraded. We live in a world in which the consumer habits have been yielding steadily to producer involvement. And so the TV audience acts now as a producer. Had you ever thought of the instant replay in football as creating a totally new form of audience participation in the dynamics of a game?
Well, I don't quite see how the instant replay enters into the dynamics of the game.
It very much concerns Cliché du Archétype. That's why I circled around to it.
Yes, I've noticed that you say that. In fact, I think I've outlined it.
Well, it isn't really an outline of the book. It's an outline of these themes as they appear in many situations outside. But in an instant replay, in effect, you say, let us stop this action. Halt it. Arrest. Hold it. Then you say, now, what has just happened in this game had this effect. Let us see how we achieve this effect. Let us replay that action and observe how this particular effect was attained. Now, this is the attitude of every artist to every artistic production. He says, in effect, hold that action. I want to capture it in another medium.
But are not the dynamics, let us say, of a football game, which is most of what you're talking about, confined to the field on which the game is being played?
Well, in the case of football, you have an audience without which there would be no game. What would a football game be without an audience? It would be a practice. Many of the best games ever played in America have been played before empty stadia as practice games between great teams. But because there's no public, there's no game. Now, today the name of the game has become a sort of...
There's a game, but there's no spectacle, perhaps.
No, there's no game at all without a public. Without the audience, there is no game. In a theater, if there's no audience at all, you have a rehearsal, but you don't have a play. Now, in the case of a playback, you are in the presence of the artistic process. An artist always says, how could I get that effect? I must go back and replay it. So what has happened to football since the replay is that the public now demands that the game be changed so that they can see the process by which the effects are attained. The games are even halted until the replays are completed on TV. It isn't just halted for the ads, but for the replays.
Now, I must say, Professor McLuhan, I had the impression that the replays were played on television while the team with the ball was going into the huddle and...
Yeah, but they sometimes have to wait until the replay is completed. The public sometimes bring their own sets to watch the replays during the game.
Well, I hadn't known that. They take these sets into the stadium,
yeah.
Do they?
And they use the sets in the stadium, in the lobbies and so on, eagerly during the game, too. Now, this is a new form of participation in the game as process. Now, in our time, the public has demanded access to the artistic process in every field, including the schoolroom. The learning process is now something in which children expect to participate, not just as consumers, but as producers. And they get this from TV.
This is because of the speed up in communications, is it?
Yes, and because TV is in a par excellence way a medium of processes. It reveals processes as never before, not just products. So that you only have to watch the more effective forms of advertising to see that the ad is never presented as a product, but always as a process of participation. This is where Sesame Street has shone, made by Madison Avenue experts. It shows the entire learning process in action and in the best advertising style. But the need for participation in process, as I suggest, is very much indicated in the popularity of talk shows, where dialogue or Johnsonian probing and digging of assumptions and patterns and so on is back in popular demand. Whereas the lecture and any form of potted packaged stuff is dead.
Is dead on television?
Or dead anywhere. It isn't acceptable in the classroom anymore.
But it is certainly acceptable to take a small point outside the classroom. The lecture circuit in the United States, for example, is enormous, isn't it? You could lecture six times a day, I imagine, if you wanted to.
I am not sure. I'm just not sure. You may be quite right that there is an enormous popularity of lectures at the moment. I think this may have something to do with people, though, going into circuit who are well-known in some other medium.
Yes, yes, that's perfectly true.
But they're here. Now, here again is where the medium is the message. In any case of a medium, the so-called content is always another medium. In movies, the content is not a movie. It's a book, a play, a vaudeville act. It is some sort of turn from another medium. In vaudeville, the content is always from some other area of the community. No medium ever uses itself as content, except the electric light. That's why I mentioned that earlier. A light is an example in which the content and the medium are the same thing. There's only one. They're not two. But to come back, though, notice that in TV, you have movies. And movies have, since TV, become art forms. They've been upgraded from popular entertainment into art. And this is one of the peculiarities of media. And they take any old cliché, and they rub it against another cliché, and they upgrade it into archetype. The process by which the banal the most trite and obvious everyday thing is transformed into something artistic is by rubbing against another cliche.
Could you give an example of that? I had to warn you that the questions would be somewhat literal.
Yes, we were playing with the example, an example a few minutes ago when I used the phrase, you say, of Ring Lardner's, "Shut up," he explained.
As I perhaps should just explain that you used that before we started the program.
The expression, "shut up," he explained, is a clash of two cliches, "shut up" and "as he explained." Both are banal and ordinary gestures, as we use in such expressions as, "well, anyway," "now," or "anyhow." These gestures of endlessly repeated kind gradually accumulate a huge charge of human experience from many, many situations. When they are rubbed against another cliche, they flash out all this energy that's in them. Now, James Joyce made a whole book of these epiphanies and flashing forth of form called Finnegan's Wake. And the title itself is one of these rubbings of cliches together, Finn, the Finn cycle, the Finnegan, and Finnegan, Michael Finnegan. The old song about he had whiskers on his chin again, long came the wind and blew them in again, poor Michael Finnegan, begin again. Now, the Finn cycle is a perpetual repetitive cycle of tribal culture, which interested Joyce very much. But the Finn, when played again and again, revealed a consciousness that was wake, awake. So by rubbing the Finn again against Finn and rubbing the tribal cycle against itself, Joyce got awake out of what had been a tribal sleep. And his theme was that our modern world is going back into the Finn cycle, but wide awake. The world of Jung and Freud is the world of the unconscious. Now, in tribal society, there is no unconscious. It's only the visual man, the highly literate man, who carefully stuffs things into his unconscious. The tribal man has everything up in his consciousness.
This is the result of print, the result of the alphabet and the result of print.
No, but I'm saying the tribal man, long before printing or any form of writing, tribal man lives corporately, not privately, in a world of consciousness that includes everything we call subconscious. Now, in the electric age, the private man has been scrapped. Corporate man is back. Again, I'm not talking about ideals. It's simply that at high speeds, the private outlook of the private individual with his personal point of view is scrapped by virtue of the speed up of electric information which goes totally around him. As electric man goes inside this resonating envelope of information, he joins this subconscious world that had previously been created by ages of private consciousness, and the gap between the private and the collective consciousness ends. It's like the gap in the world of the satellite. The rim spin of the satellite around the planet has ended nature by putting the planet inside as the content of a medium of satellites. Now, when you put the Earth inside a man-made environment, the Earth becomes an art form, and nature is over. Ecology is born. The idea of a totally programmed planet takes the place of just a haphazard nature.
I wanted to ask you about this. It's one of the questions I had written down. You have, I'm flattered to say, anticipated many of them. But the word ecology is an ancient word.
Yeah. And ecology has many meanings in our world, and including ECHO, echo. It's a world of resonance in which everything happens at once. Everything bangs against everything. An ecological world is a world of echo land. It's a world of simultaneous resonance in which people instinctively feel that everything affects everything.
But the original meaning of ecology and the origin, its Greek origin...
is not very clear, is it? The ekos is not a very simple etymology. If you've had a dig into the etymology of ecology, you'll find that it's not by any means plain. And it's a nice echo word, and it's a nice resonant pun word. It's takes you into a space where there can be more than one meaning simultaneously and contradictory meanings. When you move into a world of contradictory simultaneous meanings, you're in the world of puns.
Of which you are very fond.
Well, puns are simply ways of seeing more than one side, or hearing or taking more than one side of a thing at a jump. The old, it used to be done in terms of the Irish bull. You never hear anymore about the Irish bull. But the Irish bull was defined once, I think, this way. When you see three cows standing in a pasture, the one that's sitting is the Irish bull. Now, this is a way of trying to say simultaneously that the Irishman is not a rational, logical person in our way. That he knows very well that the Irish bull is lazy. And he does not intend to be dictated to by women. And so, the Irish bull is, if there are three cows in a pasture, the Irish bull is the one that is sitting. This is a very irrational statement, but it captures instantly this peculiar quality in an illogical world. A title like cliché to archetype is simply a way of drawing attention to the fact that simultaneously, the most profound things and the most superficial things are the same. And when you scrap nature, you retrieve the most ancient forms of cliché from the world of the unconscious and the world of the occult.
Because the word cliché in our own time has come to have a rather invidious meaning.
Literary.
And you don't use it.
It's a literary meaning.
Yes, but you don't use it in that sense.
No, I use it in the sense of any repetitive activity, and it can be on an assembly line, or it can be... The word comes from stamping paper forms with an impress. And it is itself a term from printing.
That's in French. It's taking a photograph.
And imprinting it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the photographic light act. But this fact that a new environment such as radio, any new service environment, is a cliché. It isn't verbal. But when printing was new, it created a total new environment of services that became a cliché.
Now you have written, Professor McLuhan, that printing created nationalism and it created individualism. How did it do that?
Print, for example, created what we call the reading public. There was no reading public in the Middle Ages, in the age of the manuscript. There were many kinds of publics. Today, at very high speeds of information, there is no longer a reading public. There are multitudes of reading publics, multitudes of listening publics, viewing publics, many, many kinds of publics. There used to be, in the 19th century, a much more unified public. In the 18th century, very much so, too. But since the electric age, we have decentralized, and nationalism is collapsing on all fronts in our time into tribalism or into all sorts of little small cultures. Well, with the coming of print, it became possible for the first time for people speaking a single language to have a common political form based upon the written word. And nobody expected this. nobody dreamt that there could be such a thing as a national unity coming out of a uniform printing press in which their own language was translated into this visual medium.
What then is the future of print? What will happen to it?
Well, as you can see right now that printing takes many forms, unexpected new forms, including color. Printing, I should think, is in a more revolutionary state today of innovation and development than it has ever been. And we speak of prints, voice prints. With printing has now extended its area of efficacy to many, many fields of the photographic and to the video world and to various forms of recording and so on, which are still prints. Printing has become an enormously diversified area, whereas formerly it had been relatively limited. And the going with each new technology is a new public. Now, we're not prepared for this, and it means that national unity breaks down very rapidly under these fast-moving conditions. And so all sorts of dissident groups pop up where formerly there'd been a relative homogeneity. Now, this is not necessarily good, and I think it may well be that people will anticipate many of the consequences of innovation in the future and say no.
As in the case of the SST, perhaps.
Possibly. I think that we are moving rapidly toward a time when people will inquire about what will be the consequences of this innovation as it hits into this and that field. And people will say, well, it will be revolutionary and astounding, but I don't think we're able to take it. I don't think that we can absorb that variety of shocks and that variety of changes in a very short time. Most people take a long while to adjust to quite simple changes. And when invited to readjust their entire lives every few years to very vast changes, people tend to fall apart. The loss of private identity under electric conditions has created dropoutism on a fantastic scale.
May I ask you a point on that? You have written or spoken of electric circuitry as the first new tool in 1,000 years. Am I quoting you correctly?
I don't recall exactly where that might have been said. I think it's probably defensible as a position. Although this electric circuit has created a vast number of new tools related to many other fields. That is, without the electric circuit, we wouldn't have dentistry as we know it. And when you think of the number of services related to that circuit, it doesn't limit the circuit to being a single or simple sort of tool. The circuit as an instrument, a technology, is in a very ambiguous state in scientific quarters. Most people think of a circuit as something that moves, but the scientists are by no means sure of what moves, if anything, in electric circuits. There may be fields that form here and there in the circuit. There may be new patterns and postures of particles. But whether anything actually moves, I think, is in great doubt. This is another example of the visual man thinking of connected movement as inevitable. Our scientists are still inclined to make visual models of light particles and particles that move at the speed of light, for which no visualization is possible. But this is the bias of a highly visual culture. I think our youngsters today, they're coming up through the rock and roll division, are totally devoid of any need to visualize.
I know you're not in the habit of making, what are called value judgments. You merely try to explore, as you've said. But you hinted a moment ago that perhaps all innovation wasn't good and could be resisted.
I myself am rather impressed by the limits of human beings and their powers to cope with innovation. And I really think you'll find, if you look back in human history, that most innovations were killed off at once, at birth.
It is possible successfully to resist innovation, is it?
It's very strange to... I have encountered over and over again the assumption in my readers that anything I describe, I must approve of. If it is there and if it is happening, it must be good. Otherwise, they wouldn't know how to value it. Is this an evolutionary idea of progress, that any change is part of evolution and must be progress? I wonder. I'm really baffled. I don't pretend to know the answers, but I've been called, for example, I make my living, as it were, and my whole vocation out of the book. I've been called the enemy of the book because in the Gutenberg Galaxy, I describe how the book is being changed and modified by electric technology, perhaps superseded. I don't consider this a desirable thing, but the mere fact that it's happening seems to occur to many people as value judgment. I'm baffled. Perhaps some of your audience will offer some explanations of why people would tend to assume that anything that happens in the way of innovation or development must be to our advantage.
Is there some kind of religious belief implicit in that?
I don't know, although Lynn White, strangely enough, in his book Machina Ex Deo, the idea of technology as born of God himself, argues... And as far as I know, he's the only person who does, that it is Christianity alone that has made technology possible in our Western sense, that only a very optimistic view of man and his development would have permitted the kinds of extreme innovation that we have developed in, say, the past 1,000 years. That his view is that medieval technology, which is the beginning of modern science and so on, could only have been possible under the extreme optimism of Christianity, that all pagan cultures would have frowned upon it very early.
This has something to do with the belief in the perfectibility of human nature, I suppose.
Partly perfectibility, also the idea that man deserves to be relieved from all the burdens possible by his own powers. Any of his powers are good. Anything he can do with his own powers to make life more livable is good. This is not a doctrine acceptable in other cultures, which take a much dimmer view of human activity. And the pagans, the ancient Greeks and Romans, wouldn't have for a moment entertained this idea.
I'm very interested, Professor McLuhan, to hear you say that innovation is resistible, because most of us, as far as our educations have gone, given the example of the smashing of machines and mills and that kind of thing, which didn't stand in the way of the Industrial Revolution, for example. And you referred to the SST. One of the arguments put forward for it, I'm not going to ask you about the SST, is that it is going to be built. There is a built-in assumption that the SST will be
built. If it can be built, it ought to be built. This is the strange equation.
Yes.
If something can be done, it ought to be done. This is a very weird... I think perhaps this is where the atom bomb brought people into a paradox. It could be done, and suddenly it seemed very undesirable. Wasn't it Einstein's feeling that he would have been better to have spent his life as a plumber? I think he said somewhere in his autobiography that if I had my life to live again, I'd be a plumber. It seemed it was as if he was reflecting upon the misfortune of having discovered how to split the atom. But yes, I think in the ecological age we are going to ruthlessly prune out innovation if it threatens the balance of human powers and cultural interchange.
We're now living in the electric age, are we? But most of us don't realize it. Is that correct?
The age of instant information, as a total surround, as a new cliche. You see, fish, it's not my invention, but someone said, we don't know who discovered water, but we know it wasn't a fish. People never are aware of the things that are totally surround them, and hence the cliches of technological environment are invisible. The emperor's new clothes are always invisible. Except to little children, or kibitzers of that type who are outside the game. who come in from outside the culture and are not prepared to accept its assumptions, perceptually or otherwise. So today, there isn't any game at all that doesn't have kibitzers coming in from outside the game, from other cultures. And so this is perhaps one of the causes of our self-awareness. When you have a surround of instant information, which is electric information, you have a situation surely unknown to human beings in any previous age. It means the end, for example, of subjects. When you have instant access to all information simultaneously, you can't have subjects. Children know this instinctively in the schools. You can't have jobs. You can only have roles. A job is a specialist activity with a fixed boundary. And in a resonant, simultaneous world of auditory space, you cannot retain these fixed boundaries. So jobs are out. People prefer role-playing. There is, since there's a movie coming along called Cromwell, it may have some bearing. Cromwell, in relation to Charles I, represented the application of the new print technology to military affairs, his Ironsides. And he had no trouble scrapping the old royalty, but he was unprepared for the retrieval. It's one thing to scrap, turn into camp or old hat, some recent thing, but usually when you scrap something recent like that, as print did when it scrapped the scribe and the scholastic philosopher, there's always another kick or flip, a retrieval, a sudden return of something long forgotten. It happened with us electrically with the coming back of horoscopes, ESP, and the occult. In the age of Cromwell, what came back with the destruction of monarchy was the saint. The royal martyr was transformed into a saint. And the highly religious society of Cromwell's time, Puritan society, was not prepared to entertain a royal martyr, a sudden retrieval from primitive Christianity.
Well, could that have been avoided if the king's head had not been cut off? Was that a practical matter?
I don't know. I've never heard the matter raised before. But, you know, Hamlet was somewhat in this position. One of the reasons why Hamlet, Fortinbras, the strong man, comes marching on the stage. Poor Hamlet. He was an ideal prince, but medieval style. Loyal, devoted, and fun-loving, an actor. Loving the profession of acting and the games of acting, but utterly unprepared for the serious, grim business that Fortinbras and his efficiency experts were bringing onto the scene. Hamlet was suddenly out of a job with the print. Not Wittenberg, but Gutenberg finished off Hamlet. He was scrapped and thrown on the junk heap by Fortinbras, the Cromwell of his time. The idea of marching in even rows was a startling and innovation of that time, an irresistible thing. It, even in Napoleon's time, it was considered radical to drill men on the field in rigid rows, in marching in uniform patterns. Napoleon laid planks, I've been told, on the field so that his yokels could march in straight lines, because it's not natural to march in straight lines in sequence. And he tied the legs of his men together 18 inches apart so they could march uniformly. This turning a group of men into a machine, an irresistible, uniform, repetitive machine. This is what Cromwell discovered. And the turning of society into a great machine of repeatable replaceable parts, was the Gutenberg thing as it was extended to the military and so on.
But that is going now.
It is going, and in place of that, you have the guerrilla.
Mm-hmm. Helped along enormously.
The guerrilla fighter, he may invade this studio at any moment to report or resist some outrageous thing said on this program. It's happened recently, as you know, in some of the talk shows.
Well, he can't do it here because we're cleverly evading that by taping this in advance. But I suppose the principle is the same. I suppose what is different in our time in particular is the idea of the urban guerrilla, isn't it?
Yeah. And we've had some strange examples of it up in Canada. But the sudden discovery of anonymity within the city. And in Quebec, the captors of Mr. Cross lived in the same house with the police on another floor and remained totally invisible for 6 weeks.
Should this not, under the theories you've been setting out, disappear as we begin to lead this more corporate life that you've talked about? Should not the anonymity be cut off? Should they not disappear?
Anonymous is a strange thing. I'm just thinking about the peculiarities of anonymity. Siegfried Gideon has a wonderful chapter on anonymous history in Space, Time, and Architecture, in which he explains that all the things we do absentmindedly, without any special awareness of their full intent, these are the things that create environments that, in effect, are anonymous history of our own inner lives. That just as we record the history of our inner lives on our faces, so corporately we record the history of our lives and our motives in the anonymous objects of the environment. All sorts of humble objects, whether ads or comics, all sorts of things of that type that constitute really the most revealing patterns of our inner lives.
I want to choose arbitrarily in the rather short space of time we have left and ask you a question that really has very little to do with what we've been talking about, but which I find very interesting. You've said anybody whose appearance strongly declares his role and status in life is wrong for television. Why is that?
Matching. Not making. The old concept of casting. I'm not adequate here, but the concept of casting in Hollywood necessarily is very different from the concept of casting in TV. And I've noticed myself that one of the effects of TV on me is that as I walk around in the world, I, in the ordinary, say at airports or anywhere at all, I'm amazed at the number of people who I instinctively feel would be tremendous TV material. Now, whether these same people would be good movie material, I doubt. A natural movie person has to match some category. He's perfect for this category. I don't think you have to have categories for the TV casting in the same way that you do this simple correspondence of matching, one-to-one matching.
Then what was it about these people you saw at airports, for example, that made you think they'd be great for television?
Costume. Role-playing. Today, the airports and our airplanes and our business world, our streets, are full of festive role-playing people in festive mood, going about their everyday lives as if they were medieval characters, with strange and unexpected hairdos and wonderful colors in their clothes and garments and patterns in the same. We hear about the ancient medieval clown wearing his motley, but amazing numbers of people today are dressed in motley.
This is cliché to archetype, is it?
Yes, I suppose you could say there's a retrieval of ancient cliché by means of the new cliché of TV surround. But TV viewers seem to go richly for role-playing and acting and love costumes. Now, here is where the big midi hassle is. The midi is a dress and not a costume. The mini was retrieved from ancient tribal cliche by TV. The midi is not an ancient form of costume. It's dress. It's private.
The midi came out of what? Costume movies shown
on
television?
No, the midi is just an ordinary dress.
I should say the maxi.
The maxi and the mini are costumes from other cultures. All tribal societies wear miniskirts, men and women alike. The Venus de Milo wears a miniskirt. But a miniskirt is a costume and is not a dress. And when you put on a costume of that tribal kind, you put on the power of the whole tribe. The miniskirt is power. The midi is merely a private preference. It's personal and individual. The mini is not personal. It's tribal and corporate and is pure power. And so that's where the hang-up is, if you can talk about hang-up in mini. It's a form of high-rise which has tremendous power behind it. It is high-rise architecture and miniskirts have much in common. Both are returns to the module, the repetitive module. But yes, the mini and the midi are examples of cliché to archetype that we could spend a long time on.
Professor McLuhan, we have unfortunately only 1 minute left.
All right.
You may not think that's so unfortunate, but could I ask you, what guidance would you offer ordinary people to find their way through life as it is today in about 30 seconds?
Well, I think we live in one of the richest, in fact, incomparably the richest age of all human history. There is nothing even remotely approaching the riches of human experience and knowledge and the diversity of human condition today. And our access to all times and places and all pasts and presents and all futures contained in the present today. I can't imagine anything more rich or exciting. On the other hand, if you say a guide, surely the guide is simply to use our perceptions to their maximal powers of enjoyment. I suggest that we begin to consider the world as we have now presented it as a spectacle, a very rich enjoyment.
Thank you very much, sir. Marshall McLuhan has been speaking freely. Edwin Newman, NBC News.